think tonight we're going to wrap this up. We've dealt with things that do matter. These are things that there's a lot of people in the religious world that think these kind of things don't matter. And there's different degrees of that. I'm not saying to you that people would actually say, like, for example, worship doesn't matter. Most people would say it does. We started off with the doctrine of Christ. As I suggested before, most people would say that doctrine does matter. But in their practices and the works that they do, they indicate they don't really think that it matters, at least not to the degree that it really does. As we dealt with doctrine, we emphasized, of course, from 2 John verse 9, that if we don't abide in the doctrine of Christ, we have not God. And so while some people will say, well, doctrine surely matters, they wouldn't go that far and say that it can affect our souls if we teach the wrong doctrine. And yet that's clearly what the Bible teaches, and that's what we want to get across to people. It does matter what you teach and what you believe. The church matters. We talked about that. You can't join the church of your choice. Jesus only built one church. And we have to make sure that our young people growing up continue to be founded and rooted in that truth. There's a lot of compromising going on. And, of course, people in the denominational realm want to influence members of the church, young members particularly, friends in high school and college and other places want to have an influence. The devil wants them to have an influence. And we have to teach them constantly. Teach them that there's only one church and you need to be a member of that church. And so all of these things matter. We talked last week about authority, and not only from the standpoint of how to establish authority, but just the idea that authority itself matters. And you'd be surprised how many people just really don't believe that. In fact, I remember there was when I was in Louisville, there was a debate that went on between brethren over some of the social doctrine issues. And I got that wrong. I'm sorry. What happened? That came later. There was a debate between a Church of Christ preacher and a Baptist preacher. And so it went real well for the Church of Christ preacher. Evidently, he really did a good job defending the truth and made it clear that the Baptist doctrine was wrong. And in those kind of debates sometimes, this is with a liberal brethren, what they would often do after those kind of debates when they think they really whipped the opponent, they'd have kind of a victory. I don't even know what you would call it, but they'd get all the preachers to go in the back and, you know, kind of celebrate, I guess. I don't know. Well, in this particular situation, Aaron Earhart was there, attended the debate. So they called him back. So here he is with these preachers who don't feel the way he did with regard to liberalism and that sort of thing. And, you know, back then, you know how Aaron was. So here he is surrounded by liberal-minded preachers, and he couldn't keep it. He couldn't just, you know, take it and go. He started to challenge them about, yeah, you did a great job with this Baptist, but. And in the course of that conversation, one of the preachers, as they were going back and forth, admitted, he got to the point where he asked them, is there anything then that we as churches of Christ can't do? I mean, do we have to have authority for everything? And the liberal-minded preacher denied, no, we can pretty much do what we want to do. And that's a mindset, isn't it? And I've often said there's a lot of things that are different between conservative congregations and liberal congregations so far as practice goes. But these days, a lot of it is a mindset. Like I've been with several churches where we would withdraw from somebody, and for a scriptural purpose, like they're in an unscriptural marriage, and they'll just go over to the liberal camp and they'll accept them. And over the years, liberal-minded brethren basically teach the same thing that we teach on that. They have some of the same struggles. Like, you know, we have, if you're a member here, you'll recognize this, but we have like the Homer Haley doctrine and that sort of thing. among liberal brethren, they have their Homer Haley too. It teaches the same thing that Homer Haley does. And most conservative liberals would oppose that. And I could call them by name, but you wouldn't know who they are. But for every false doctrine on divorce and marriage, divorce and remarriage, we know the brethren within the conservative camp. There's a counterpart in the liberal camp. It's amazing. And so through the years, what I'm saying to you is, through the years, we have divided over authority and using the Lord's money and the social God, those kind of things. But we've been on the same page, mainstream liberal brethren, on things like marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But over the years, when you start developing an attitude towards the Bible that's more liberal, that door continues to open. And now, I've seen several situations where liberal brethren will take someone who they know is in an unscriptural marriage. And in fact, I don't see, he's in the back teaching now, but Dwayne had that same experience when he came over to us. One of the things that influenced him was not just the social issues that was important to him, but also because the preacher where he came from was, they were openly accepting individuals that the whole congregation knew they were in an unscriptural marriage. And that's a mindset. And so these things do matter. Doctrine matters and authority matters. And all of these things matter. And if you begin thinking loosely, pretty soon nothing matters. And we'll see that from a moral standpoint here in just a couple of minutes tonight. But with regard to worship, we're not going to spend a lot of time with the, I think we're familiar with this. It does matter. John 4:24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And generally, we over the years have emphasized there's two things in that passage that's under consideration: worshiping with the right attitude, worshiping according to the word of God. And I have said, you've heard me say over the years, that we have the worshiping according to truth, we have down pretty good. And conservative, sound churches of Christ. Doesn't mean we're perfect. But I'm confident that everything we do here at Brown Street, we can put our finger on the passage. There's not one thing we do as a congregation that's unscriptural. We worship according to truth. I'm absolutely confident about that. Doesn't mean that we're perfect as a congregation. We have our faults and flaws and weaknesses and all of that. But when it comes down to worship, just think about anything that we do that you can think of that we shouldn't be doing. There's not anything. If there is, bring it to my attention. And so don't bring it to my attention, bring it to the elders' attention. And we need to do something about it. But you won't find that. We worship according to truth. Everything we do, from the music to the Lord's Supper to the prayer, everything we do, the work that we do, is scriptural. But the other part of that, the right attitude, is still something that we struggle with as individuals. You have to make absolutely sure when you're worshiping God, every song that you sing, every time you observe the Lord's Supper, every time you serve God in any capacity, that you have the right spirit and the right attitude. Your heart is right in doing that. And so all of that is important. Let's make sure that we're doing that. We're worshiping God, not just according to truth, but in spirit. All right, we could say a lot about that, but we've preached many sermons on that. I want to get down tonight, as we close this up, talking about morality, because morality matters. And if I were to ask you, what is the biggest problem we have as a nation, and really even as a world, what's the biggest problem in the world? And you'd get all kinds of answers with regard to that. The economy, somebody would say, and political problems certainly would be at the top of some people's list, and just all kind of issues would come about. But really, the biggest problem we have as a country has to do with the morals of this country. We're in a moral mess, and it's getting worse. And it's not just our country, really, it's the world over. We are worried, of course, as citizens of the United States, of the direction this country is going in, particularly, but the world's in a moral mess. And so that is a huge danger to us as a country, and then with regard to us as individual citizens of this country, and just individuals in our various homes, our various lives, morality is a problem. It's a huge problem. And so I suppose as you start talking about morality, the thing that has to be asked is, well, who determines what is morally right and morally wrong? Morals has to do with a standard of conduct that has to do with right and wrong and just behavior according to the standard. But who decides what that standard is? And what is that standard? Is there a standard that reveals absolutely what is morally right and what is morally wrong? And that's really where the moral train of this country, and again, the world, has kind of jumped off the tracks. There's a lot of moral skepticism in the world. And the moral skeptic is the individual who basically says there is no absolute standard. There is no way that we can say that something is just wrong all of the time. There's just no standard like that. I said last week, I think as we were closing, that we live in the postmodernism times. And what all that has to do with, first of all, when modernism, it was a sort of a philosophical element that came into the world, the turn of the 20th century particularly. For about 30 years, it was really being fought. From 1900 to 1930, what modernists did is they fought the establishment. And so every established belief with regard particularly to arts and literature and politics and science, and then, of course, it spilled over into religion. And anything that was established, they thought was wrong. And fought against it. And so they got to the point, the modernist, where they were opposed to all religion. And the modernists, basically, we often simply refer to them as the secular humanist. And that's what they are. And their basic idea was, we don't need God, we don't need religion. All we need is man. We just need ourselves. And so there were several things. Here's the Miami-Dade College professor there said the first characteristic associated with modernism is nihilism, the rejection of all religious and moral principles as the only means of obtaining social progress. In other words, the modernists repudiate the moral codes of the society in which they live. Now, that became very popular. And that's going to have an impact on a nation, isn't it? When that becomes the collective mindset of a nation, you reject all moral codes that the standards that you've been used to, you reject all of that, that's going to lead to an ungodly society. And that was basically the case. Alan E. Hires, who is a liberal preacher, but he edited the Spiritual Sword for years, maybe still, I'm not sure. But he said modernism was based on nationalism, the idea that all things could be explained by nature or natural law and natural causes. And what he's saying there is it can be explained by natural causes as opposed to anything divine. See, it's a rejection. Modernism is a rejection of God. Of course, the Bible becomes a casualty in that kind of thinking. And so that was modernism. And for about 30 years or so, it really, really flourished. Then in the middle of the 20th century, it started to change. And professors in colleges, and it hadn't gone away. Like, there's still a lot of secular humanists today. But a lot of people of influence in our universities and even in our high schools and those involved in education who have an influence on young people in our society, they kind of moved on from modernism, and they had a totally different approach, and we're still right smack dab in the middle of this now. It's the postmodernism era. And they, instead of rejecting religion, they accept religion. All religion. The only thing in this postmodern society today that is rejected is if you believe your religion is the only one. That's a problem. And because they don't believe that there's any absolute truth. So it's a rejection of any standard. So now we get back to our morals and what and who determines what the standard of morality is. The postmodernist says, well, there is no standard. There is no standard. And you can't force your standard on somebody else. It's all relative, see. Here's a quote from this guy is one of the founders of postmodernism. He says, there are no facts, only interpretations. All claims to the truth, to meaning, to value are merely social constructs. They are therefore impressionistic, relative rather than absolute, largely fictive and subject to erasure. There is no uniform, universal reality since moral relativism, which is a philosophy. Everything is morally relative, just depends on the situation. Multiculturalism must prevail. The issue all becomes those of politics. What weighs in finally is not truth, for there is none. And that's postmodernism. There is no truth. There are no facts. It all just depends on you and your situation and your culture and your background and what you determine. No absolutes. Now, you stop and think about that. Listen, that is what we're living in right now. It's the direction that this country is going in. That there's a lot of people, particularly young people, who are being taught in universities today who believe exactly this. And again, the Bible becomes a casualty in all of this, which means when you throw the Bible out, now morally speaking, you're in all kind of trouble. And when you develop a generation of people who believe there's really no moral absolutes. In fact, one of the, we'll get to this a little bit later. They do say there is one abiding principle that has to be accepted, and that's love. And so, you know, as long as whatever you do, whatever is right and wrong, it really boils down to whether or not it's done lovingly. But that's, how do you determine that? And who's going to determine that? And so, but that's kind of, you stop and think about it, you're living right in the middle of a culture that believes that here in the United States of America, that's where we're going. Like, remember I said last week, I think it is, that we used to be a so-called Christian nation? Well, we're heading towards being an atheistic nation. And that's a real and present threat. There's no doubt in my mind about that. That as a young generation grows up and they think there's no absolute standard, and with the Bible, so you can't use the Bible to determine what is morally right, morally wrong. Your head, in fact, that has already happened. Turn over to Romans chapter 1. You remember, I know you're familiar with this, but look at this. Romans chapter 1, this is almost describing us to a T, the direction that this country is going in. And more people, our young people are going to school with, and people in the business world and politics, our politicians, and you can't use the Bible. There is no absolute standard that determines right and wrong. And now look at this in Romans 1. I know you're familiar with this. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. Any of that sound familiar? We have people in high places in our country right now who deny that God is the creator of all things. This is us. He's not referring to us, of course. He's referring to the Gentile world back then. But this describes the direction that this country is going in. I've said many times that used to be people who believe in evolution and that sort of thing. They disagreed with us, but they would at least listen a little bit. Now they're completely belligerent. And like, if you believe in creation, a God created the heavens and the earth, you're just totally ignorant. And that's moving away from the Bible. And you get a nation like that moving away from the Bible, and we're going to end up just like these Gentiles here in Romans chapter 1. He says, verse 21, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man in birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to the lust of their own hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. That's what happens when you dismiss the Bible. It can't lead anywhere else but to immoral living. And what he goes on, of course, most of you know, what does he go on to talk about? What kind of immorality does he describe? I wonder if that sounds like our country right now. And again, really, the whole world. It is a moving away from God. And again, the postmodernists, they don't care at all. They don't care if you serve your God. Just don't push his beliefs and his will on me. You believe in your God, we'll believe in our gods. In fact, we have a country made up of a lot of different people who believe in a lot of different gods, and so that's wonderful. And Jehovah, Yahweh, gets pushed aside. And again, the Bible becomes a casualty to that. And how in the world are you going to control morality once you get rid of the Bible? Like, how do you prove homosexuality is wrong without the Bible? How do you do that? You can't. There's only one reason why homosexuality is wrong, is because God said so. And how do you conclude? How can you prove that lying is wrong without the Bible? And the list goes on and on, or whatever moral issue you want to deal with, drunkenness or whatever it is. How many people who honestly think there's nothing wrong with getting drunk wonder why they push the Bible aside? You, there's very few things morally that you can prove is wrong without the Bible. Same-sex marriage without the Bible, how do you prove that's wrong? It's wrong to us because we know what the Bible teaches. But we're living in a country now. All of these things are prevalent, aren't they? Abortion? We know abortion is wrong. Why? There's some common sense involved in that, but the Bible. And no, but you can't push the Bible on us. That's postmodernism. Say, no absolute truth. And so what they would really say, oh yeah, there are some situations where abortion might be wrong, but there's some other situations where it's not. And they say, there are some situations where adultery would be wrong, but you know, there are some situations that call for adultery. And that's the position that they take. That's the position that they believe. Because everything, moral relativism, it's all relative. It depends on the situation. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. When you start moving away from the Bible, it's going to destroy a nation. Joseph Fletcher was a fella in 1966, he wrote a book, Situation Ethics. And he, again, is strong in the postmodern movement. And that book was extremely popular. And again, he basically believes that love is the only criteria. And what makes something right or wrong? He says, hence, it follows that in Christian situation ethics, nothing is worth anything in and of itself. It gains or acquires its value only because it happens to help persons, thus being good, or hurt persons, thus being bad. And that's the only principle that regulates man, according to people who believe in situation ethics. It's all situational. And I'm saying to you, believe it or not, we live in a country right now who strongly believe in situation ethics. So nothing's always wrong, just depends. Just depends on the situation. And that, to me, is the biggest threat we have in this country and probably in the world. It's abandoning God, and we end up being atheistic as a nation. Oh, that can't happen. That's Romans 1. That's Paul's point in Romans 1. All of those Gentiles, there was a time when they believed in God, but they didn't retain God in their knowledge. They thought they were so wise. Let's get rid of God, then we can do our own thing. Let's get rid of any absolute authority, then we can do what we want. And they ended up being what they were in Paul's day when he wrote this condemning letter. And that's the direction that we're going. Just pay attention to it. Most people, and so many people, particularly millennials, and they grow up thinking, no, there's no absolute truth. It's all subjective. It's all relative. And as long as you love, you can't do anything that's going to hurt somebody. You have to treat other people well. But there are situations where, you know, adultery might be a compassionate thing. I mean, like, you can paint any picture of almost any sin being favorable, that it might help someone, so it's actually an act of love, and you're in a moral mess. And that's where we are. And so this situation ethics, and of course, you see here, he talks about Christian situation ethics. There's an atheistic kind of situation ethics that they again reject the Bible altogether. This fella and people like him, they think they're Christians. So they think this idea of situation ethics is biblical. See, they think they can go to the Bible and prove that situation ethics is scriptural. And give you case one, Rahab. Right? What'd she do? She lied. But in doing so, she protected the Hebrew spies that came on into Jericho. And so, yeah, she lied, but if she would not have lied, then they would have been caught, and that would have ruined things. And so she, not only would they, Mr. Fletcher say that she didn't sin, he would claim the Bible commends her for what she did. And, you know, they look at, of course, look over at Hebrews chapter 11. We know the couple of passages that speak of her. Hebrews chapter 11 and at verse 31. Hebrews 11 at verse 31, we find that she made the list of the Hall of Fame of the faithful. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Oh, God approved of her. Remember over in James chapter 2 and at verse 25, it says that in the same way was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? And so Mr. Fletcher and all of those others who believe in situation ethics would say, yes, she lied, but the situation called for it. I've even had a gospel preacher, a friend of mine, I won't call him by name, but a friend of mine who we didn't get deep into it, but he brought it up. I was kind of surprised he brought it up. He believed that there are occasions when lying is okay. And brought up her. Now, I'd be interested in him developing that a little bit. Like, what? Now, what don't you find in these passages that speak of Rahab? Even when you go back to Joshua chapter 2 and read of that situation, what don't you find? Right. There's no scriptural record at all that God condoned her lying. Ever. There's not a hint of evidence that God condoned her lying. But she obviously, if you go back and read the account in Joshua, she somehow developed a faith in God. And of course, she was still a prostitute. And I don't guess I've ever heard anyone say, you know, God was okay with the fact that she was a prostitute. No. If she was going to maintain favor with God, she had to stop the sin in her life. But the fact of the matter is, she was a sinner. She was from a pagan nation. And she had developed a faith in God. She had heard of what was going on with the people of God and how God rescued his people from Egyptian bondage and the opening up of the Red Sea. She was familiar with all of that. And she had faith. Develop faith in God. And that's why she was commended, not because she lied. There's not a single passage in the Bible that you could look to and say, see here, God condoned her lying. That's a stretch that they just want to use that as a case, as proof of their situation ethics theory, but it doesn't work. Yeah, go ahead, Matt. Right. And I'm not going to talk about that here because they'll ignore that. That's not a case for them. That disproves their belief. But I'll give you another case. David. Look over quickly to Matthew chapter 12. I'm sure you're familiar again. Matthew chapter 12. This is another case. People think that Jesus himself condoned situation ethics. And here's what happened very quickly. Matthew chapter 12, and at verse 1, it says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain. Excuse me. And to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Now, let's just pause and make sure we understand right away. They were wrong. The disciples did not do anything unlawful on this occasion. They didn't violate the Sabbath. They were not to work on the Sabbath, but plucking a piece of corn was not a violation of the Sabbath. If they got a sickle out and you know, took down a whole row of corn or whatever, then maybe. But plucking a piece of corn was not a violation of the Sabbath. So they're just wrong about that. But they say, look at your disciples, what they're doing. They're doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath. Now, he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which was not lawful for him to eat, not for those who were with him, but only for the priest. And so Mr. Fletcher would say, see that? Jesus is justifying what David did when he, 1 Samuel chapter 21, I believe it is, where he went in there and he was on the run from Saul and he ate the bread that was meant for the show table. And now they say Jesus is justifying that. He's not justifying that at all. There's nothing in here that indicates that Jesus justify that. In fact, as we just read, Jesus called David's act what? Unlawful. the only thing Jesus is doing here is not justifying that situation. He's not saying, oh, my disciples broke the law, but it's justifiable because, look, even David broke the law, and in that situation, it was okay for survival. He's not saying that at all. He's pointing out their hypocrisy. He's saying, you're condemning my disciples for doing something that's not unlawful, but and yet you accept David, and everybody accepted what he did in eating that showbread, and he obviously did something unlawful. That's hypocrisy. That's inconsistency. Wayne Jackson in the ChristianCarrier.com, he has a pretty good website, he summarized it like this. You gentlemen revere David as a great king and Hebrew hero. David once clearly broke the law by an illegal consumption of food, yet you never condemn him. On the other hand, my disciples have violated only your human tradition, and yet you charge them with sin. How very inconsistent are you? And that really is the point. That's the only reason why Jesus brought up that example of David. He wasn't justifying situation ethics. There is nothing in all of Scripture that justifies situation ethics. The bottom line is this. There is an absolute standard of right and wrong. What is it? It's the Word of God. And God is the authority. And what God says is wrong is wrong, no matter what the situation or the circumstance is. Like, see, again, people today say, well, you know, fornication, that's okay if they love each other. If it's just pure lust, then that's probably wrong. But if they're really in love, nothing wrong with premarital sex. Well, fornication matters, doesn't it? And every form of fornication matters. And idolatry matters. And we're living in a society again. Well, there are all kinds of different gods, and different people have their different religious beliefs and world religions. And nothing wrong with all of that. As long as they live by the standard of their God, well, idolatry does matter. Drunkenness matters, and lying matters, and stealing matters. It all matters. But only if you believe that there is a standard that's absolute and that we have to live by. And there is. But we have to keep teaching our children about these things do matter, and morality matters. How you live your life. There is a moral standard that comes from God that you have to accept. And in this society, that is slipping away, and it's slipping away rather quickly. It frightens me that our children, grandchildren particularly, what kind of world they're going to live in here 20, 30, 40 years from now. Because this postmodernism is real and affecting the minds of a lot of our young people. So it does matter. Appreciate your attention.